Canadian investors are using ZSP over any other ETF for exposure to the S&P 500 index. Institutional investors, investment advisors, and DIY investors have all been trusting ZSP with their investment dollars since the fall of 2012. ETFs provide instant access to a portfolio of stocks to an investor in a single cost-efficient trade. For an investor to own the entire index would require institutional-level trading systems and expertise. To accomplish this, an investor would have to buy 500 stocks at a time, and then as the market moves, it would constantly have to rebalance those 500 stocks several times a year. ZSP simplifies this process by aiming to provide instant access to the 500 stocks in the index in a very easy and low-cost way.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to Loony Hour, episode 131. As always, joined by the three amigos, Boomer, Keith Dicker, IceCap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM Global. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen.
Yeah. So guys, we had the solar eclipse this week. Did you see it?
Did you look into it?
Yeah,
I saw it. I was amazing. It was so much better than I thought it was. In Montreal, we had 4 whole minutes of totality. Let's just say I was distracted. It was so cool. I'm very much a nerd about this, and it was awesome.
Was that a good date? Like, is that a date opportunity?
I mean, there's a joke about 4 minutes in there somewhere, but I'll let that lie. Well, I think that it wasn't. It was in the middle of the day. I was at work. Everyone seemed like everyone in the city poured out into the streets and with their silly glasses on and stared at it. And when it was a full eclipse, a totality, it took off the glasses. And it was honestly marvelous. It was so much cooler than I was expecting.
Did you guys get a Steve out west?
No, it was like cloudy, dark, raining.
Regular kid slander day.
It didn't go over British Columbia. It was from Mexico, like southwest, all the way through Texas, and then, you know, Louisiana, and then all the way through Maine. And yeah, there you go.
So what a difference the world is or it makes. So when I was a little boy back in the 70s, not the 1870s, the 1970s. There was a solar eclipse then. And I remember like comparing it to like this week, you know, school children were off early. Everyone's getting ready to watch this stuff. When I was a kid, you know, the solar eclipse was, I think it was in 77 or something like that. And I remember in the afternoon, all of a sudden in schools, they closed all the curtains and all the kids had to get under their desk. They had to stay there for an hour. You could, if this thing touched you, you know, you're going to die. So you're all under the desk. And there's this one kid, his name was Corey Keats. He was a bit bigger than all the other kids. So he was sticking out a little bit from under the desk. Oh man, we didn't think Corey was going to make it, but he did, Steve. He made it.
Joke. I don't really know what's going on.
That was a terrible story.
It's a difference between, you know, 70 years ago. Well, no, so in the 70s, like 50 years ago, whatever it was, to today, like, you know, the world is different.
Science has come a long way.
Yes, the stories are getting worse anyway.
I do want to apologize off the bat here. My mic broke. So if anyone's listening to this on Spotify or Apple and wondering what's going on with the sound levels, I do apologize. This company, Shure Microphones, I think we can all attest, they kind of suck. These are like $300 and they break like every 6 months. So
is this the second microphone you've bought of these guys?
This is my first, but the cord broke like 3 months in.
Yeah.
I'm on number two.
I think it's called planned obsolescence, I think is what that is.
Shrinkflation. They just break sooner.
Hey, Steve, why don't you tell everyone what's happening next week?
You tell me. We'll tee that up in a little bit. We'll tease our listeners here. We do have a special guest today. We want to sort of prep before he comes on the show. So we have a gentleman by the name of Chase Barber, and he is the founder of Edison Motors here in BC. They're basically one of these electric vehicle manufacturers in BC, and they're doing a lot of big things. So young startup company, and there's been a lot of controversy lately. We love a good controversy at the Looney Hour with the BC government's green scheme grants. Basically, there's this company where basically involves a company called MNP. It's an accounting firm appointed by the government to administer significant clean technology grants, under which case they have a 20% success fee. So basically they submit the application and then they're actually responsible for approving the application. And so basically if you don't use them and they don't get their 20% toll, miraculously your grant doesn't get approved. And so they've kind of got their hands in the cookie jar. This is turning into a massive scandal. The BC NDP tried to bury it. They said, no investigation. It's gone completely viral. It's blown up in the media. And now, of course, they were forced to say, okay, we'll allow the Auditor General is now doing a thorough investigation into MNP, the accounting firm, which again is doing some interesting things. So we will get Chase's opinion, not only on what's happening, what's the real story behind this this green slush fund. It sounds like a Rive scan all over again, except the BC version. And then we'll also get his perspectives on the energy transition. I mean, a guy that's front and center of the EV change. You know, BC is all about, you know, electrifying everything, you know, from houses to cars. And so I think he'll have a really interesting perspective. Rich. This is your buddy.
No, I'm really excited because, I mean, listen, any regular listeners to the Looney Hour know that we've sort of panned EVs. So, and we've sort of mocked sort of a lot of the, I'd say, mandates. But that's not to say that they don't deserve sort of their time in the sun. I mean, there's lots of applications for these products. And just because we think that mandates are stupid doesn't mean that, you know, inevitably they'll eventually carve out a significant portion of the market share, whether it's in trucks, as we're going to hear about today, or other types of vehicles, industrial applications. I mean, there's a wide-ranging reasons why you might want to have an electric vehicle. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, I think it's just great to sort of encourage budding entrepreneurs in this country. Like I said last time, you know, the only way it seems to get rich in this country is either land or lineage. And it's nice to see someone is actually trying to do this sort of the old fashioned way, which is sort of design a product that people want clearly and hopefully sell a whole boatload of them. So yeah, that's sort of my two cents.
I think you left out the third way to get wealthy in this country.
Oh, sorry. Go on.
Become some kind of a consultant to governments.
Yes, excuse me. Sorry, we're gonna get in trouble now.
My mic is gonna get shut down now. That's right. Start,
what do you think would be the Looney Hour Consulting Group or something? Anyways, well, but yeah, well, so there you go.
That's one way to get your lake house built faster, Rich.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, but all after we bring Chase on, we will of course talk markets. There's been a lot going on in the news. We had an announcement, some commentary from the BOC. Of course, they held the rates. We had some updates from the Fed. We had a hot US CPI print. We had some carnage in the bond market. We had some updates from the ECB. We got Christopher Freeland stroking more checks. So we got a lot to cover after Chase. So but without further ado, let's bring in Chase now. Chase, welcome to Looney Hour.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's been it's a pleasure to have you on. Maybe for those that aren't familiar with you, your story, Edison Motors, can you kind of give us the elevator pitch?
Yeah, so elevator pitch, basically, we were a bunch of logging truck drivers that decided we were fed up with the way that electrification was going, trucks were going, too much planned obsolescence, going down a route that just didn't make sense. And we said, oh, well, screw it. We can probably build our own electric truck and do a lot better job. And that kind of led to Edison Motors.
That's crazy. How long have you guys been around now?
Oh, about 2-3 years.
Nice.
Yeah, two and a half, 3 years now.
So how, a lot of- Yes. I have to say, you know, Chase and Steve and Rich, so the world has been trying to figure out this whole EV trend now for a long time. And you guys figured it out over a weekend and a few pints, it sounds like. I think it's amazing. It's a compliment, by the way. I'm not trying to go a different direction with it.
No, 100%. There was a few beers involved on that one. But we just looked around and we're like, oh, electric kind of makes sense, especially for logging. You're going uphill empty and you're coming downhill loaded. So you're using that stored potential energy of the logs up at the top of the hill to recharge those batteries as you're going down. And then you don't use much power to go back up. And then we kind of looked at it and we're like, oh, even in this, which is one of the best case scenarios, the batteries aren't going to be enough to get a truck through the day. Like, that's literally one of the best things we could think of. So we kind of looked around and we're like, well, other things are electric. And they seem to work. Like at the sawmill we were hauling logs into. I don't know if you guys have heard of RG Laterno, but they've got three Laterno log loaders. One was made in 1969, 71, 1973. These things are over 50 years old and unloading 200 to 300 logging trucks per day. 50 years later. And they were diesel electric. So we're like, wow, that really makes a lot of sense. Why don't we just look at diesel electric? We could still take it to all the advantages, the huge amount of torque, huge amount of power, they're regenerative, but we could still have the diesel for the range. So diesel makes a lot of sense for trucks because you can do a full 15-hour day, 16-hour day. That's a weakness of electric. So let's combine the advantages of electric, the advantages of diesel, and let's make a turnover from the 1960s.
That's amazing. First of all, I think, yeah, congrats. Who knows how this will work out. We honestly wish you the best. This, first of all, just amazing what you've done. I think the diesel electric is something people might not know is a lot of the trains are also diesel electric. I'm sure you know that. The big trains that haul all kinds of stuff across the world. A lot of German and other submarines are diesel electric, so thanks. But one thing I wanted, if you could like just articulate, is your sort of the kit car aspect of the trucks you've built. You mentioned in one of your videos that you pulled a lot of these parts and stuff off the shelf. Can you explain that and sort of go into the planned obsolescence and sort of your efforts to sort of combat that?
Yeah, that's funny. A lot of the companies all starting out, a lot of people said, well, you'll never be able to do it. Companies spend billions of dollars on this R&D to go down these route to build their electric vehicles. And we're like, yeah, they're spending billions of dollars, but they're making $1,800 headlights and super customizable parts. And, you know, it's all of their own parts because their whole motto is, well, we want to be able to sell you parts. We make a ton of money off parts. Let's make sure that you can only use our parts. And now we got to spend all the time and engineering effort to design our own parts for the vehicle. Whereas we just walked into like the local parts store, the local electrical heavy duty supply store, and we bought those parts. And we're like, like you say, freight trains have been electric since the 1930s. They've been diesel electric. The parts exist. So we just grabbed those parts off the shelf, and we just had that issue with the 3-in-1, where we blew up the 3-in-1. Well, we didn't blow up the 3-in-1. We actually blew up the BMS, but that's a different kind of issue.
What's a 3-in-1? What's a 3-in-1? Sorry, explain that.
3-in-1 takes one voltage, and it converts it over to three different voltages. Because the power steering, the air compressor, and some other electric stuff runs off of three different voltages. Like that's just what they suppliers made them at. So we needed one to take the voltage that the electric drive axles would have and the battery voltage and then convert it over into the voltage required for the other parts. So it's just a 3-in-1 converter. But what we found was that 3-in-1 converter was relatively limited. It only wanted to take an RPM range of a voltage range. But the generator... So when we lost the BMS due to a mistake we made, we hooked up a wire wrong, fried it. Oops, our bad. But that means that, well, we should still be able to drive it off the generator. Even if we lose the batteries, the generator should be able to direct drive the motor. We won't have as much power. But what we found was in order to meet the power for that 3-in-1, we had to run at a lower RPM in order to spin the generator and the stator to reduce the voltage, because when you do reduce the RPM, you reduce the voltage, and that lower voltage is what that 3-in-1 lost, which originally what the batteries were doing. So by going and grabbing another 3-in-1, well, we could increase the voltage, which means the generator can then run the truck direct drive as needed. But
I'm not sure anybody really understood that, but that's okay. It sounds very, very impressive.
This is the innovation that we need in this country.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was what I wanted to say. I mean, can I ask how much a truck costs? Like, how much does it cost to buy one of those trucks? I'm on your website now. It's not really clear. I mean, and relative to your competitors or in regular trucks of that nature?
Relative to a normal diesel truck, you're looking at about like 25-30% more for one of the new semi trucks. The pickup trucks, you're around about half-ish of what a new truck retrofit it.
Okay, amazing. So competitive at least.
It is competitive because, like I said, the parts were relatively cheaper because we used them off the shelf. Some of these parts, the patents have expired in like the 1960s, 1970s. Like people could just produce these parts. Like, turns out when you don't need $1,800 headlights, the price comes down a little bit of a skosh.
I mean, that's so fantastic.
Is all the production and your clientele like all in BC?
Our clientele isn't, but right now all of the production is. We're
okay. So let me get this straight. You've there's a problem we're trying to solve. You've come up with an innovative kind of really fascinating way of sort of dealing with that problem. You've sort of addressed some of the issues with planned obsolescence. It's a competitive price product. It's manufactured in-house. So you're creating jobs or hopefully many more jobs in the future in British Columbia, generating tax dollars and employing lots of local people. And this seems like a perfect product to, let's say, get some backing maybe from the local government and maybe some support even from the federal government. Can you explain how that's gone for you?
I have not gotten any support whatsoever for our... We made literally the world's first plug-in hybrid. They classified it as a plug-in hybrid. Actually, they even classified it in one place as full electric, but with range extended. Like, okay, if we made the world's first electrified solution and emissions reduction solution to heavy vocational trucks, we're like, hey, couldn't we get a grant? Couldn't we get a little bit of funding? Like, they gave $285 million to a company from Taiwan to look into batteries. Like $285 million to a company from Taiwan to look into batteries. And we're like, can a local guy get like, you know, a couple hundred grand? They're like, no, absolutely not. You don't get the money. So that was quite frustrating, I guess. I mean, who knows? We're a bunch of truckers, but it's just, yeah, there was the one grant program in specific that we were like, come on.
Walk us through that, Emin. That scandal with MMP.
When we started looking into it, like, it one was literally for the Commercial Vehicle Innovation Challenge, doing electrified solutions to heavy duty commercial trucks. We are the only manufacturer of heavy duty commercial trucks in BC. It was a BC grant. We're like, okay, we're literally the only one building these. We should have a good chance at that. Nope, didn't get that one.
So you applied just to sort of round this out for people who may not know your story. You applied for the grant, and so you did some paperwork, you filled in your name and your eye color and whatever it is you have to do to get a grant. And then you submitted this grant, and then what happened after that? They said no, and then?
Oh, well, the whole story starts kind of a little bit before that. This one company had reached out to us to ask to write our grants. I think we said no. I think we decided that they were too expensive to go with. Then they reached out again and we're like, not really. And then they reached out again and we're like, no, you're too expensive. And then we got turned down for the grant. And when we got around the time we got turned down, we noticed, oh shit, this grant is being administered by the same company that's asking to write our grants. And then we started like, I feel like we got to get a grant. We got to go with this company. Because when we started like doing our little research into it, and we're like, wow, this company does the economic assessment of funding opportunities for low emissions vehicles. So they recommend the companies to fund, and they write a paper recommending companies that the government should look at funding. Some of those companies on the list are like that one from Taiwan that got $285 million. So this company is recommending funding and grant opportunities to the province. They're administering grants, and they want to write our grants. And now I'm not sure whether they were directly saying we want to write the grants that they administer, but like that's what their website was implying. And the grant process is so convoluted, and it's not really sure who writes what. So I'm not going to take that just thing, but like, yeah, they were definitely doing ours because I just don't know. But like,
okay,
it's strongly what was implied that, hey, pay your 26% success fee, you're going to have better luck. And you're like, well, yeah, you guys like run everything to do with this entire program. It looks like if we use anybody else, you'll deny it, because this was a grant that seemed perfectly suited to us as the only company in the province doing this thing. And we still got denied by your company while you're trying to say, hey, you should hire our company.
And then you went to, so you took this all the way to City Hall, but you know, effectively you took this sort of problem that you identified. I won't use the C word, but our Looney Hour listeners are quite smart. I'm sure they can put two and two together. So you took this file and you went up to the court, the parliament. And what happened then?
Yeah. So we actually got invited down to the parliament bill because we just got our registration license plate, which means we had built the first semi-truck manufactured in British Columbia since Western Star closed their plant down almost 30 years ago. So like the first one built in the province since then. So they brought us down there to be like, hey, that's awesome. Good job, guys. And we're like, yeah, we did it. And they came in. They're like, hey, how has the government been helping you? Have you been getting the help you need? Have you guys been getting some funding? And we're like, no, we haven't. And they're like, well, how come? And I'm like, well, because we didn't go with this company that administers the programs to write our grants, I think. We weren't hiring the company that administers everything. And they're like, wait, what? Okay. And then I'm like, yeah, they do all of this, and this, and they wanted to write our. So I think we didn't get it because we weren't in with the in crowd yet.
Interesting. And then they blackballed you from a speaking engagement, I heard.
Yeah, because we're like, oh, yeah, this seems super sus. I'd love to say it's something about this. And they're like, well, we'll definitely look into it. And then a couple hours later, we got our invitation at a speaking engagement that's organized and were funded by this ministry. I think it's funded by the ministry. Not sure they technically do the organization of it, because it turns out this government doesn't really do anything themselves. I mean,
what was the speaking engagement? What was the conference for? Just to really put a bow on it?
It was for commercial electrification to show off what BC can do for electric commercial vehicle innovation. Once again, now that was a more broader scope. It was more just everything from electric lawnmowers to electric tugboats to electric semi-trucks. But we're one of the few BC companies, and we got invited to come speak. And there's going to be a lot of people from commercial industries who are companies that are looking at an electrification. They'd love to hear your talk, promote yourself. We got that speaking engagement canceled at basically the same time where the government's like, hey, we'll look into that. Yeah, no. Then speak engagement. I'm like, how come you haven't been even if they claim that, hey, we've looked into that and that wasn't our ministry saying to take you off. The company that was organizing it just decided to do that on their own. Okay, like the coincidence of that is insane. But even if it is, do they not think it's ironic when we went in there and saying, hey, has the government been supporting you? And we're like, we've gotten no financial support. This was the only thing the government had done to support us was host an event to allow companies to show off their local innovation. And they canceled that at the same time the government was saying, hey, what can we do to support you? Also, we're canceling your thing. Like, come on.
So I'll step away and let the other guys ask you questions. But since your sort of TikToks have gone viral and, you know, I'm sure we're not the only people to sort of ask you to tell us what's going on. Have there been any sort of bigger industry, you know, I don't know, whether they're parts manufacturers or people like clients or what have you, have they sort of sort of gone over the head of the government and asked and been like, hey, we want to support this guy, or we just love their products and we're interested in, or has this really sort of hurt your chances in sort of expanding your business?
We had already kind of sold the trucks we wanted that we can build. So we kind of sold off all our capacity. I think we have room for one more truck we could do next year. But so far from our customers, we've heard that good on you for doing that. Like, yes, like we definitely would hurt ourselves by not getting government grants. We could have went along with everything and, hey, you know, we'll hire the company that runs the whole program to do it. And I'm thinking and, you know, theorizing that that would have increased our chances at getting government grants and, hey, don't rock the boat, just go along with it and keep the funding. Like, yeah. So
it was wrong. And you have something called integrity, which clearly this government lacks, but I'm sure, Steve,
I think they said we'll be better off long run. Companies that have integrity and honesty kind of like, okay, we believe you, like, you'll stand behind your product a little more, or hopefully that's a little bit of a consolidation, is that we're really proud of you. It shows the kind of company that we're dealing with, and it makes us feel good about dealing with an honest company. But like I said, it's one of those things where it would be nice to have an extra few million dollars, because I'm currently still living in my parents' basement, because all the money goes into the company to fund our development and our research and building the products, and the money we sell from the truck goes to building the truck. So like, there's, as a startup, it's what you got to do. It'd be nice to have some help, but
it's like a lot of people in BC. So right. How are you actively involved now? The Auditor General or Attorney General there is doing their investigation into MNP and the practices that are going on with this
They haven't reached out to us yet, but come on, that investigation, like, number one, they said, hey, when we met with the meeting, we'll look into it. And then they blocked an investigation, and then new evidence came to light, which I don't know what it was. Maybe they just went to MNP's own website and just Googled their own website. Have you guys seen that? Like, literally on their website, they kind of suggest that this is exactly what they're doing. So maybe the evidence was like, hey, maybe we should just Google the company we hire. But whatever, they came back and said there's new evidence, so we're going to investigate to see whether they broke any rules. And like, never once have I said that they've been breaking any rules. I'm saying that the government set the rules up to allow these kind of conflicts of interest. The government decided to hire one company for every piece of their program that does everything in the program, and then also hired that company to do the audits of the government. So that company's auditing the government, running the government program, doing economic assessment of the government activities, administering the grant money, and they also do applications for grants to clients that they also do accounting and auditing for. My issue wasn't that this company broke the rule. It's that the government hired one company to do absolutely everything and then are acting stunned. They're like, conflict of interest? How could we?
Can I ask you another question? So, I mean, is this, so just like stepping back, sort of having like more of a holistic picture on transition, this industry, this cottage industry, sort of, I mean, the grift, I think that's going on, not just in for trucks in your province, but whether it's windmills or solar panel, whatever. I mean, does this put a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth? Do you think that these people who care so much about climate change, I mean, is it just another angle to sort of extract as much sort of economic rent? And they're just using this as the next thing? Or do you think these people care at all about, you know, what they pretend to care about? Or, I mean, has this sort of changed your view on this? Or are you still hopeful? Yeah.
Just as straight up personal opinion of mine. It seems like a load of bullshit. Like, why? What, we're spending so much money on so many government programs, and I think people are seeing that, like, hey, where is this money being spent? You're spending billions of dollars on childcare, daycare systems, yet it's 3-year wait list at all the clinics. You're spending more money on healthcare than you ever have, but emergency rooms are closing down. You're spending all this money on electrification of different things. Like, where's that going? And then people are saying, like, why are these grants going to multi-billion dollar companies? Like, companies that have billions of dollars, if it was really a good idea, they could fund the programs themselves. Billion-dollar corporations can go to their investors, they can go to their financing options, they can go to whoever they need, and they could fund the programs themselves if they were good ideas. And then when you're spending your own money, you're efficient at a program, because, like, we've been very efficient because we've been spending our own money. So why are they going to billion-dollar companies that are just playing with taxpayer money? And why are these programs seem to be not achieving results? I think most people could just look at the results we've been seeing out of the government and saying that, yeah, we are not getting the value that taxpayers are paying for. You're increasing carbon tax. You're increasing all of our taxes to pay for these programs. Where's the benefits of these programs? Like, I look at our just even infrastructure alone, as they increase spending on infrastructure, Highway 1 in Vancouver was built between, like, if you look at between Langley all the way up to Chilliwack, was built in 1964 as a two-lane highway in the 1960s. Now, in 2024, what, 60 years later, it's still the exact same two-lane highway. They haven't built a new highway or added an extra lane in 60 years. Where's all the money we're spending on all the fuel tax, transit tax, every other tax, and we're not getting anything new? Like, come on.
Hey, Chase, you know, one of the themes that we've been talking about quite a bit on the podcast and Lunier, by the way, we've had some really great stories and conversations, and this might rank up there pretty high. I think we'll see what's going to happen. However, one of the overriding themes we have, that one of the reasons Canada is struggling with other things economically, is productivity. And we talk about it, it is declining in Canada. And what you just described from your perspective, it hits it to a T. It just lines it up perfectly. Don't you agree, Steve, and Rich as well?
Yeah, you've got this, clearly you've got this, you know, innovative startup business that, you know, is doing exactly what the government says people should be doing, which is, you know, innovating, spending their money, pulling themselves up by the bootstraps and solving or working towards, you know, a cleaner environment in the process. And obviously, seeing how these programs are administered is definitely, it's concerning. And I think, you know, we've seen scandal after scandal over the last several months. So hopefully, you know, we wanted to bring you on, obviously, just to shed light on that, what you guys are doing. What do you see as the clearest path forward for Edison Motors as we get close to wrapping this up? Just how do you guys plan to sort of execute moving forward?
Well, we've sold some trucks, so we're building 8 trucks next year. We can't do them all in my parents' backyard, so we're looking at buying a shop, and we're going to start building some trucks in the shop. We'll build trucks, we'll sell them to customers, and we'll use the money, and hopefully we can raise a little bit of money so that we can buy a shop, so that we can get a little bit bigger, hire on a few more guys, build a few more trucks, start selling trucks, start bringing some money in, and just become a business. Move from just research and development to sales.
True entrepreneur. Chase, we need more people like you in this country. And like you said, we wanted to have you on, highlight your story. Appreciate you coming on, and you know, wishing you and Edison Motors, obviously, all the success that we can help in any capacity. Feel free to reach out. But I think likewise, it's our audience as well. You know, we've got people from all parts of the country, some powerful people that are listening to the show, and hopefully we'd encourage them to reach out to you as well and see if they can start moving the needle.
On the one thing where you say we need more people like me, we have a lot more people like myself. There's nothing really unique about me other than I was incredibly privileged to be able to live in my parents' basement. I don't have any kids. I could just pursue my dreams. We've got a lot of people, but we're just not supporting the people like me. If I had kids or I had a mortgage or anything else, I couldn't do this thing. But there's so many people that I have met in this industry that Canada could be a world leader in this clean tech. Like, especially BC could really be that clean tech Silicon Valley of the North with how many innovative, passionate people I've met. Like, Canadians are so brilliant and such out of the box thinkers. Look at our military track record that, like, if we actually supported our own instead of supporting outside billion-dollar corporations and through a huge bureaucratic system, we could have a lot more people like me, and we could really be doing a lot of change that people historically have enjoyed seeing from Canada.
So Chase, just, I know we're supposed to let you go, but I have one more question. Like, what would be like the maybe one or two or even three things that you think that small time entrepreneurs like you would need? I mean, apart from money, obviously, but you know what I mean? Like, whether it's less regulation or this, I mean, what is it that you basically need? I know we have to go. Sorry, Steve, I'm screwing the timing up here.
Sorry. Honestly, a lot less bureaucracy. We need to have either a little bit lower taxes, or we need to make sure that our taxes aren't being squandered by super large corporations, that the money isn't just leaving Canada, that we're not just giving subsidies out to billion-dollar companies to leave it. Take those subsidies that are going to multi-billion-dollar companies, give them back to the average person and let the average person, and then get rid of the amount of bureaucracy. The fact that you have grant-writing companies that get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to write grants for people or charge crazy upfront amounts with no guarantee of success means that people that can't pursue these cool ideas, like, get that bureaucracy out of the way, get that money going out to the big companies that could fund their own, keep the money in Canada, keep the provincial money within the province, and get rid of the bureaucracy and just let the market go to work with cool ideas, cool innovation. And the government just needs to get out of the government's own way.
That's awesome. Amen. All right. Well,
amen. Thank you very much. Chase, appreciate you coming on the Looney Hour. That's been fantastic.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Wishing you all the success. That was an interesting conversation. I feel like, Rich, in terms of Carolyn Rogers, break the glass on productivity. This might be a clear example.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. Listen, who knows if he might be the next, you know, Ford or not. But I think a couple of things really came out in that was, number one, he's obviously clearly passionate about this project. I think that's really important. Two, I think it's really disappointing that he feels stifled. And three, I think it's, you know, he's doing what this government coast to coast espouses to care about, and yet he seems like he's not getting the support that he needs, it which to me, it tells me that a lot of this climate stuff rings very hollow. Again, you guys know my view on natural gas, etc. I don't know, Keith, if you want to add something.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points as well. First of all, you know, Chase, you just got a very good introduction to the swamp, and the swamp it's deep, it's messy, it stinks, and you know, we talk about it all the time. It is what it is, and is, you know, it's not a great experience, of course, what he's going through, but it also, you know, you help develop a few calluses along the way. And I think that is the challenge that we have here, not only in Canada, but in other places around the world, is that people just don't appreciate and understand all the waste that takes place from the public sector. And, you know, we need governments. We can do so many things better. And on another episode coming up, I'm going to talk about how we can revive the tax act here in Canada, because that's another swamp as well. But these guys, you know, they got together, had an idea, and they figured it out. And that's what innovation is about. Somebody else, you know, they might be introduced to them, and maybe they can make it even better, or, you know, they could leverage their ideas and, like, who knows what. But to hear this story, having to go through that, it's, and you know what they say. So, you know, all of the, you know, the grifting that's taken place and all that, you know, I would imagine this is it. Like, there's nothing else going on, either at the federal or provincial municipal level, everything else is clean as a whistle. So once we get this one sorted out, we'll be good to go on. The other point, I think now it's quite obvious, and it's not a good point, guys. We like to keep score on things. So now we have the government 2, truckers 0.
No, it's the other way around.
No, they still lost, right?
The truckers are 2, government 0.
Well, truckers, I think they lost. I think they lost in both cases.
The truckers have lost? Anyways.
Yeah. But keep playing, right?
But anyways, we'll lots to talk about this week in the markets. Boomer, you had the Bank of Canada, which came out the same day as the U.S. CPI release. Which, Rich, you've been kind of keeping a close eye on that. But I think on the Bank of Canada's front, to held rates. Keith, you and I were watching, texting during the press conference there with Tiff Macklem and Rich's girl, Carolyn Rogers. But it seemed like a dovish cut. You know, someone, I think the first reporter says, you know, does this open the door for rate cuts in June? He just flat out just said yes.
I think it was a dovish hold. I think that's what we would. Didn't we have the panic pause a few months back?
Yeah, we did. That was a good one.
Dovish
yeah.
hold.
Yeah, it's a dovish hold. Yeah, you know, the Europeans did a... The ECB did the same thing this morning as well. And then, of course, you know, the main story that we've been talking about quite a bit, we will come back to Canada, of course, is that, you know, it's with the Americans. And it seems like they desperately want to cut rates, but they can't because the data is still strong. And if you look underneath the hood, you can always make an argument that they should be cutting. But as long as the American, you know, the data stays where it is, all of a sudden, you know, the market, remember 3-4 months ago, they're expecting, 150 basis points in cuts by the Fed? And now that got cut to 75, definitely June, they're going to start it. And now it's probably July.
Wait, we talk about Canada before we head down south for the weekend? Is that okay, Steve?
Yeah, follow the script, Boomer.
Anyway, yeah, but it goes back to the Canadian story. And the point is that, you know, with the Americans at that level, and that they don't, you know, they're not going to cut. And all of a sudden, the Canadians are saying, well, we kind of want to cut. And the same with the Europeans. It creates this, like, combustible bang, pow, snap. You still can't hear it, can you?
Oh, God.
Rich, you have some comments? I want to comment on the press conference afterwards.
Yeah, well, so to me, I don't think it was, listen, so I didn't read the statement. What I did do is watch the press conference. And for me, I don't think it was that dovish, to be honest with you. I think when pressed, I think he came out and said what he's been saying for ages. Which, and to quote him, almost quote him verbatim, I was typing this up, so I might be a little bit wrong, was they're focusing on core, and we are effectively looking through mortgage interest costs, because that's been a big, you know, people saying, oh, mortgage interest costs, whatever. And the other thing that I said, he said supply of housing has not kept up with demand. So again, the shelter, the rental component stuff. And he says, and inflation is still too high. And risks remain. I mean, he does everything in his power not to mention the P word, which I find very funny. But again, my takeaway was that it was not, I don't think they're going to cut anytime soon because of many of the reasons we've talked about, which is shelter, sort of the higher rate as a function of the deficit spending, which, by the way, is growing, and the population growth. And certainly Keith's point about America not being able to cut either is part of that because of the currency knock through. I don't know, Steve, if you had...
Well,
different
Keith,
view.
I'm kind of curious your thoughts because, like I said, you and I were kind of watching it there, and it was like one of the reporters asked him, you know, about U.S. CPI because that obviously came out that day, and he says, "Well, listen, like we're not focused on U.S. CPI." Again, they're going to say what they need to say, you know. So he says, "We're not focused on U.S. CPI. We're focused on what's happening here in Canada." Yeah. You know, and he talks about all his core measures obviously coming off and sort of starting to fall in line. You know, and then the next reporter said, well, what about the currency? You know, do you kind of factor that in? And he, Keith, the takeaway I had about the currency was basically that's going to be the sacrificial lamb. That basically they felt, given where the oil markets were and our ability to absorb a weaker currency through exports. To me, he basically threw the Canadian dollar under the bus.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's a sacrificial lamb or maybe the sacrificial moose or beaver or something.
On. Was that your takeaway?
I'm just laughing at Keith's horrible joke. Sorry, keep going.
But it's the same as the Japanese right now. You know, you can't bail out both your bond market and the currency market at the same time. It is one or the other. And, you know, we continue to go down this road where maybe growth doesn't fall off a cliff, but inflation stays sticky. And these guys have no idea what to do with that. They're damned if they do, damned if they don't. And, you know, they're worried for them to say, you know, we don't really look at the American data. I mean, that's BS. I mean, you know, sure. They do. Of course they do. I mean, I mean, if they don't, if I'm there and I would have said, whoa, are you telling me you guys don't look at the American inflation data?
That'd be amazing.
You guys should be fired immediately. I mean, go work for what? Well, okay, what's our new favorite BC MNT. Company? Yeah, go work for those guys. I mean, as a central banker, you absolutely have to be aware of your surroundings.
No, of course he knew, stuff. But that's just theater. That's theater.
But Steve is hitting on a really good point here. You know, in between the lines, they're saying, and that's what we believe as well. You know, when push comes to shove, they will come in and they will bail out the bond market if they have to. Remember, a bond market will go no bid. So if you're, you know, if the bond market goes no bid, it means there's no price. How do you market on your book? And who holds all the bonds in across the country? There's two groups. The banks hold them as their regulatory capital. So you can't have that marked to zero. That doesn't work. And pension funds, you know, they hold like 20 to 40% in the bond market. And they can't have that go to zero either. So the Bank of Canada, like, you know, they'll come in and they'll do, you know, infinite open-ended QE, which means the Canadian dollar, you know, gets hit. So best case scenario, though, Rich, is that we don't get a slowdown. You know, things sort of get into this real sort of, you know, ugly, nothing is happening stage. And I think we're all starting to hear anecdotal stories now how, you know, the economy is slowing and, you know, people are starting to struggle a bit. But it's the currency side. That's where you make your money there, Rich.
Yeah, no, sorry to interrupt you before. I think you're right on the currency piece. I think, but I would say it's not only just the bond side. I think it's sort of they're in a position where they choose the consumer and consumption, which is related to housing market and higher debt servicing costs, and the currency. And I have to say, I think Stephen is right in the sense, I think that they're going to sacrifice the moose or the beaver or whatever and sacrifice the currency. But I think that's, you cannot devalue your way to prosperity. I think, you know, the Japanese have tried, other countries have tried. I think that there are some real challenges and knock-on effects that come down the road as a function of letting your currency fall to whatever it is, if they don't raise rates, if inflation stays sticky. And this is, again, why it's crucial that productivity improve, which is why Carolyn Rogers is harping on it, and that they get the deficit spending under control. I mean, we always talk about the federal deficit, which, by the way, is, you know, the economic expectations for that federal deficit starting to go lower and lower and lower. But we don't include the provincial deficit, which you throw on top of that anyways. So until those two things happen, I think that they can't cut. And I think the currency is that release valve. But we import all of our goods and the currency will eventually flow back into higher goods imports, higher costs. And the last thing I'll say is imagine if we did not export 4.9 million barrels of oil a day and get all that hard currency. We would be completely and totally. And, you know, I think that's how you sort of square all these circles. I don't know, Steve.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to comment on that because there's obviously like a lot of people are like, you know, super worried about the Canadian dollar. You know, it's going to become this, you know, what the peso was 10 years ago, whatever. And, Keith, here's your thoughts. Carl Shimoda, he's on Twitter there, chief market strategist. He talks a lot about the Canadian dollar. He put a good chart out showing that the Canadian dollar actually outperformed during yesterday's sell-off. So we know what happened, right? Which is US CPI came in hot, US dollar surged higher. And so on a relative basis, yes, the Canadian dollar fell, but it actually still had outperformed on a relative basis what the yen did, what the euro did, what the Aussie dollar did. The Aussie dollar was actually the worst performer on the day by actually a long shot.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. Rich made a good point that the beaver is a noble animal, by the way. So you, with the currency side on cross rates, Canadian dollar did do well yesterday. But that just tells you that, you know, no one is paying attention to Canada right now. And when they finally do start paying attention, that's when you should start to see, you know, some big movements here. But, you know, today, for example, you know, most currencies are sort of flattish here again today. But, you know, the Canadian dollar is sort of underperforming today on a cross basis. So, you know, you will get a lot of noise, you know, from one day to the next. But you look at it, like, big picture, and that's the problem with the markets today. Like, everyone is, you know, minute by minute, hour by hour, and all that stuff. like step back, look at this big picture. And the big picture is the Americans are now likely won't be cutting if they do until July. And then what happens? How many more meetings are left after that?
Two? I can't.
Yeah, I know. So two. So
well, no, but one's off the table because of the election. Sorry, I know that's a little bit tinfoil hat, fat hat for Richard a little bit, but
yeah. So they're not going to be able, if they still think they're going to do 75, you know, by year end, it means it's 25 or 50 before the election, and then another, you know, 25 after the election. But it's
yeah. But so I just follow this strictly through like the housing lens, which is like, you know, that most people I think listening to this show are going to say, well, what does this mean for me and my mortgage that's coming up for renewal? And, you know, Bank of Canada is supposed to cut rates this year, and, you know, it hasn't happened yet. And like, I would still like to emphasize that even when they do cut this year, let's just say that hell starts breaking loose, as our buddy Ben Rabideau talked about a couple episodes ago. Growth really disappoints to the downside. And let's just say, best case scenario, Bank of Canada cuts rates 100 basis points this year. You know, they start cutting in June, and let's call it 100 basis. Let's just hypothetical. Let's call it 100 basis points. That still would take your variable rate mortgage from about 6.5% today. It only brings your variable down to 5.5. Like, your fixed rate mortgages are in the low 5. So like, I'm not sure bringing your variable down 100 basis points is going to do anything for anybody.
Yeah, but if we get if the Bank of Canada cuts by 100, you're probably not working either. So you might save a bit on your mortgage. I'm telling you, look, work it. It'll be.
You think that feels like a bit dramatic to me?
I agree. If they cut by 100, it means there are job losses across the country. So
right. But the mortgage market, yeah, you know, was. It's still a relatively liquid market. People will still want to buy houses, et cetera, no?
If you think you're... So even if you don't lose your job, you have a feeling, wow, I might lose my job. And that's what affects savings and investment.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
I
saw people losing their job hand over fist during the pandemic, and people were out there bidding on houses. So I'm... color me skeptical.
Well, that's where I was leaning towards. That's why I mentioned it.
Well, you know,
I had clients, this is not a joke, this is not exact. I had clients literally being like, we are fully prepared to compete in multiple offers on this property tomorrow. We're going to do all our due diligence ahead of time. We're ready to go subject free, no conditions, all cash offer. You know, call the guy in the morning, say, okay, what are we writing up for the offer? And he goes, oh yeah, I can't offer anymore. I just lost my job last night. You know, it's just like, people don't, in my experience, I just haven't found that the average person has the foresight to say, is my job secure?
Well, to be fair, I think people in Vancouver buying houses, they don't represent the average person.
That's a good point.
That is true.
I think if you're chatting with someone in Southern Ontario and, you know, they're slugging it out doing whatever they're doing, and all of a sudden they feel like they're going to lose their job, or they're running a business and they know that, hey, revenue might fall 10, 20% and the costs are higher. I just think that people are a bit more mindful.
Yeah, Vancouver's a wealth market. I mean, look at the prices. I mean, you're competing with global cash from all over the place.
Yeah, that's a fair point as well. That's for sure.
So what's going on then? So we got the Fed. The Fed's not.
Well, should I go over the CPI just quickly?
Well, yeah, you've been all over this path in terms of CPI is not coming down to where it needs to be, and there'll be no cuts. Like, you've been all over this, so I mean, this is your party to run with.
Yeah, so just quickly, I mean, headline CPI came out. It came out hotter than expected. It was 0.4 for headline. Core inflation was second month in a row of 0.4 month on month. And so annualize that, right? Just quickly, you know, you multiply it by 12. That's not quite right, but you get the idea. And we're starting to see sort of, you know, for a long time, we talked about this, inflation was sort of stuck between 2% at 2% and went around. And now I think 3 is the new 2. who knows? But for me, just a quick takeaways, because I know we're sort of running out of time, which is goods CPI in the US is basically stuck at 5. So, you know, it stopped, it was up all the way to, you know, 8 or whatever, and then it started to fall again. We'll share the chart on YouTube. And now basically in the US, it's sort of stuck at 5. And then the other thing that I thought was really interesting is my favorite, shelters come down, but guess what? services X shelter, if on like a 3-month annualized basis, is now it's up like at 8.7%. So we're really sort of bottoming out in that services component. And services, again, is a lion's share of the personal consumption expenditure of U.S. households, same in Canada. And we're just seeing like that it is now the new normal, Keith. And as a function of that, that's why the market freaked out. You got, you know, 20 basis points on the 2-year bond yield. The 10-year bond yield sold off by something like 18 basis points, which were big, big moves. And I just think that people, the reality is, I think functionally, the monetary policy is still too easy. There's been the financial conditions have just really, really eased over the last 6 months, and they probably should be hiking, but they won't for a number of reasons.
Have you, Rich, have you done any deep dive analysis on base effects and how those are going to play out over the next 3 to 6 months? Because there's some smart people that I'm following there on Twitter that are suggesting the comps or the base effects actually get more challenging every month moving forward.
What do you mean by more challenging? Just to, so I understand.
Yeah, basically, we've seen CPI come down quite a bit. It's obviously kind of been stuck over the last several months. But the base effects actually get more difficult moving forward, i.e. a lot of what dragged CPI lower is now going to start sort of coming out of that equation. So thus, basically, CPI is actually going to move higher because of the change in the base effects, obviously. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So that's why I bring up this services X shelter. And that's why I talk about sort of the annualized pace. And so that by doing the annualized pay, the 3-month annualized pace, you sort of ignore the previous 9 months. It's a bit unfair. You get extra volatility in that series. Some people might disagree, a little cherry picking a little bit. But what it does allow you to do is sort of like, you know, take your microscope in just a smidge and you sort of highlight just the last quarter. What's going on in prices for the last quarter? And it really is sort of, and so that sort of answers your question. I think those 3-month annualized figures sort of deal with those base effects. And as you say, Steve, we are starting to shoot right back up. That doesn't even, by the way, include the fact that oil, Brent oil is, I think, 90, WTI is at 85. That feeds into gasoline prices. Crack spreads are starting to rise, right? That's the price of the, that's the spread between the refining cost and the crude oil. And you have higher gasoline prices. Guess what happens when you raise gasoline prices? It feeds through to the rest of your economy. I'm laughing because the freaking carbon tax conversation is just absurd. Of course, higher prices for gasoline feed through the rest of the economy, and that has knock-on effects. And so, yeah, it's deep. I think those people probably did a better job than I did, but that's exactly right.
Keith, how are you looking at this from the ECB's perspective? You know, the economic fantasy land over in Europe, you had Lagarde, I think she was out today. I'm curious if you've been following that story.
Yeah, so all this is moving as we expected. However, last year, at the end of the year, November, December, nothing made sense to us. We're looking at the markets went against us at the end of the year. For us, it was a bit soft. And we just said, none of this makes sense. And now we've done a 180 from there. So now remember I talk about this path all the time, or the journey, and you know, all that stuff. I didn't say Aerosmith that time, Rich. I didn't say it.
I always laugh. It's so dumb. Anyway, carry on.
It's so dumb. It's stupid. But now we're right back on that track. And Steve, think about it. Everyone is trying to survive based on rates being cut. They're saying, hey, we can't survive with interest rates at 5%. I mean, that's lunacy. It doesn't matter what level interest rates are at. If you're able to borrow at that rate and make a return higher than that number as a private company, you know, not a government subsidized, entity, whatever those guys are always doing out there, you will bore at that rate. But it seems like everyone's on pins and needles. Everyone's now an expert on CPI. And for that reason, you know, we are set up for, you know, a likely disappointment here coming up. So again, we continue to go down this road where, you know, that the bond market especially is just looking horrible. So see what's happened to the bond market the last few days? What's the best word to describe it?
Got mullered.
It's been absolutely mullered. And it's, you know, it's the safest market in the world, apparently. But people are losing money on it. So we'll see as we go here into the spring. I mean, what are equities off, Rich? 2% from the high? 3%?
Yeah, not that much. I think they're going to come under a lot of pressure as these cuts get priced, continue to get priced out. That's my view.
Isn't it crazy? Markets are down like 2 or 3% and everyone's freaking out. So yesterday, I bet you a lot of people around the world yesterday maybe lost, you know, one percentage point or 1.25% in their portfolios.
Can you explain for like our listeners like a bond auction? So for example, U.S. Treasuries yesterday had their worst day since May of 2023. Apparently the 10-year auction was so bad that dealers were left with 24% of the auction, which is the most since November 2022. So can you kind of walk us through that if you're at one of these auctions and the mechanics that go behind that or perhaps the significance of that commentary?
Yeah, so what happened? So the U.S. Treasury, just say they're going to raise, let's just say it's $10 billion that they're issuing in debt, a T-bill or a T-note or a T-bond, whatever it's going to be. The Treasury doesn't sell it directly. Now, a retail guy can buy it a little bit direct if they want through Treasury Direct. But in general, they had to go to Wall Street to sell it. So Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, those guys, they'll take on the inventory and then they'll more or less price it. They'll say, hey, we're going to sell, you know, $5 billion of a U.S. 10-year bond and we're going to price it at a yield of 4.4%. And did I say $5 billion in this example?
You said 10.
Okay, say matter. 10. Okay. I think I said both, to be fair. And so they want to sell $10 billion at 4.4%, and they're only able to sell, say, $5 billion of that 10. So in terms of how much of it has been covered, it was one of the worst auctions they've had in a long time. So then in order to sell, you know, to clear the book, they have to lower the price, you know, which raises the yield. So then they go from, say, 4.4 to 4.5 or something, and they're able to sell a bit more. The whole indirect is like a sort of smaller bits that are coming in for it. But it's not. So, but the other thing yesterday, you know, that got a lot of attention, but it's because it was a horrible day anyway for the bond market. So, it's, you know, a lot of books were trying to be cleared and things like that. The other thing that caught everyone's attention, I think it was the day before, there was a pretty large buyer of call options on basically the Fed funds rate the day before. Did you guys see that story?
No. Was it Nancy Pelosi? Sorry, I couldn't.
No, like they loaded up. I think it was around $75 billion was notional what was traded, and obviously that trade got mullered. It would have went to zero most likely.
You know, then it was definitely not Nancy Pelosi. She would have gotten that trade right.
Correct. And people saying, oh, man, someone just lost their shirt. No, they didn't. They were very likely hedging their other position. So they would have been very concerned that it was going to be a very soft inflation number, you know, and then they would have been offside on that side. So my point is, don't always take everything, you know, one for one from what you read in the headline news. You know, come to the loony hour. Here are the deep analysis. You get a better perspective.
Speaking of the Loony Hour, you wanted me to plug this. Now's your chance. There is a meetup. There is a meetup with Boomer. Rich, are you going to?
I am. I've been invited.
So I'm not going. I was not invited. But Keith and Rich.
Well, you have better things to do, I think, right?
We'll be anyways. In Toronto next Thursday for a couple pints. There's no tickets being sold. It's just come by, have a drink. So if you want venue details, if you want to come by, email Boomer. Keith, your email is easy to find on IceCap website or even on the Loony Hours website. So very easy to find it. But if you guys are interested, of course, Social Hour with Keith and Rich next week.
Yeah, Looney Hour Social Night. I think this year we've all agreed that, you know, as three of us will travel around quite a bit, you know, with work and fun and stuff, that we're going to try to, you know, put aside a couple of hours, you know, to get together and, you know, make some good friends. But I'm there next week. Rich is coming over from Montreal. So maybe it'll be me and Rich and maybe just Mrs. Ice Cap. That's it. But we'll hopefully. Anyway, if someone wants to come along, just send us an email and then we'll send you the details at that point.
A couple other notes too. We've got big housing announcements. At the time people are listening to this, again, we report on Thursdays. There are expected to be some large announcements from the federal government on the housing file tomorrow. So we'll see. We'll unpack those obviously next week. But I actually have I got a call with Sean Fraser tomorrow. So we'll see. These guys are really trying to win me over. We had Mark Miller last week, Sean Fraser this week. What's going on?
I'll tell you what's happening, Steve. Are you ready? There's an election coming up. And they're going to need someone. They're going to need someone to run and wear a red shirt. Vote for Steve.
Vote for Steve.
Change the world. Change the world.
In all seriousness, there was a couple announcements today on the extended the amortizations for first-time homebuyers. So 30 years.
So you can fix your mortgage rate for 30 years or is that?
So how it works is you can get a 30-year amortization as long as you put down 20% down payment, which means you're not an insured mortgage. You're not going through CMHC. So the bank is warehousing the risk basically. If you put down 20%, you can get a 30-year amortization. So obviously any investor, whatever home buyer. And if you're buying, you know, a $2 million house, of course you're probably putting down 20% or more. So you could always get a 30-year AM, or you couldn't get 30-year AM is through the government's own products, which is basically insured mortgages. So for example, through CMHC, is they cap those amortizations at 25 years. You remember back in the Harper days, they used to be able to get 40 years. You used to be able to put 5% down and get a 40-year amortization leading up to the first wave of the housing bubble in 2008. And so they've extended that from 25 years back to 30 years, but only if you're a first-time home buyer and only if you're buying a new property. So
I've questions.
It's a very small segment of the market.
Huh?
Does that make sense?
No, it makes zero sense. What's the purpose of the policy?
Okay, let's be honest.
To make it a bit easier cash flow wise for someone to buy a house, for sure. Right?
Yes. Yes. I think as a politician, you angle it and say, we need to help the young buyer. He can't compete with the investor who can get the 30-year amortization. So we'll allow them to have the 30-year amortization. That will lower their monthly mortgage carry cost and they can get into the housing market, start building equity. That's how you frame it politically. Obviously, let's be honest. Yes, it is a demand subsidy. It does.
Thank you.
It does. Longer term, it does. It's a demand booster. It's going to support the prices.
And what happens when you keep supply anchored and you raise demand?
The good thing is, I will say, is like this program.
It goes up.
The price goes down. Up. Thank you.
I'm going to be honest. I don't think it's, in my opinion, I don't think it's a bad policy per se.
Fair enough.
I just think like, everyone's so worried about like the wealth gap between like investors taking over the market and first time home buyers. And so it's like, well, if you want to level the playing field a little bit, probably makes sense.
But the wealth gap is really between boomers and millennials. That's the real wealth gap. I think the investors is a red herring, right?
Well, I think the investors get a lot of the bad publicity because who's going to have sympathy for an investor?
Right. But the real wealth gap is between people of a certain vintage and then the people who all voted for Justin Trudeau in 2015 and got absolutely killed for it. Let's be very honest, right? I mean, the numbers are very clear.
Well, and then they also increased the, I think you're allowed to withdraw 35,000?
I thought it was 60. It was 60, I thought.
From your RSP.
Yeah.
So they said, oh, and we're going to allow you to borrow.
So you're 60. Borrowing from your future.
To get into housing.
To increase demand in a world where there's not enough supply. I mean, it's just
the election's coming up though.
It's a bit sloppy, guys. It's what sloppy. Was the animal? How do we wrap this up with, how do we tie in the animal theme from the beginning of the episode? I forget.
No, I don't know.
I don't remember. Why did we bring up the moose and the beaver?
Oh, it was the moose.
I don't remember. But why?
Anyways. It was a sacrificial moose.
There we go. Yeah.
I remember. Anyways, all right. It's just slow. It's, oh, well.
Anyways, so we'll see what kind of goodies come out tomorrow here on Friday, but expect more to come.
Okay.
That's it.
Good.
All we got.
Come hang out with me and Rich, guys. It'll be a night to remember.
All right, we got to sign off. See you next week, guys.